Welcome to the Brain Health Mission podcast, exploring how science, policy, and everyday choices shape the health of your brain and what you can do to protect it.
Hello, and welcome back to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where we explore the science, strategies, and stories behind brain health in neurology. I'm your host, Dr. Jana Middelfart-Hoff, neurologist and treasurer of the European Academy of Neurology. In today's episode, we will talk about what happens when we are lobbying for the brain, when brain health is to become an issue in European politics. Joining me today as our special guest is Fred Desterbeek, directly from the European Brain Council in Brussels. To start us off, Fred, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are you?
Hello, Jana. Thanks for the invitation. So I'm Fred Desterbeek. I'm the executive director of an organization called the European Brain Council, which is based in Brussels and, running advocacy work for brain health, brain innovation and brain research with the EU institutions. I'm trained as a political scientist in international relations, European affairs. I also specialized in association management. And, I've been around in EU circles and what we call the Brussels bubble for 25 years now, which is obviously making fields older by the day.
For the European Brain Council, and to the listeners and to me as well, what is actually the European Brain Council? What does it do and who does it consist of?
Well, historically, the European Brain Council, so the EBC, was born from this idea that we needed to bring the community together and speak, so to say, with one voice, because there was a lot of fragmentation in the ecosystem and the claims by all the organizations involved in the brain space. When it came to the first programs providing public funding for neuroscience in the context of the framework programs for research and innovation developed by the European Commission. So that was, in the late 90s. And the European Commission themselves recognized that there was the need to try and harmonize and bring together the key societies, because there was like too much, dissonance in the message being brought, in the sense that they recognized the need to prioritize a little bit better brain research or neuroscience, as it were, but they didn't really understand how to do that and how to achieve this. And it was really at a time where neuroscience was considerably lagging behind in comparison to fields like cancer research, diabetes, cardiovascular. And there was this vision by president of EFNS back then, a predecessor of IEN, Professor Olesen, who brought together then not only neurologists, but also psychiatrists, neurosurgeons, basic neuroscientists, and also invited the patients, recognizing that the voice of the patients in this equation was extremely important, as well as then the industry, because we really had this idea of embracing the whole of the value chain and try to understand what was the unmet need and how we could be then convincing to EU institutions. So that's how the EBC got structured around patient organizations, and we now represent the federations of people living with a neurological condition, as well as the federation of people with a mental disorder. Then next to the patient groups, we have the professional and scientific societies, amongst which the EN, but we also have EPA for the psychiatrist, ECNP, neuropsychopharmacologist, the neurosurgeons, as I said, basic neuroscientists. So really like the big disciplines having a stake in this change and this promotion of brain research and positive brain health. And obviously, we also work with industry partners via an industry board and a mechanism of financial support of our activities. But again, having this vision as to how we advance brain research, how we incorporate innovation in healthcare systems, and how we defend brain health for the European population, and defending that at national, European, and international level.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually, it was a small revolution, I would say, that for the first time, all forces are joined together for the brain. there had been sporadically separate alternatives, you know, neurologists, patients, the industry and so on. And I think that the genius strike here is that in the European Brain Council, all are gathered. Would you agree with me on that?
200%. It's interesting you say it's a revolution. We very often, I mean, mentioned that the model is relatively unique. I mean, there are a lot of organizations present in the Brussels bubble. You can imagine a European organization for anything that you come across in your life. I mean, cars, computers or whatever, doctors, obviously, the brain, then the heart and whatever. But an organization bringing together these different components, as I described, there are none that are still in existence or in activity. And we are about to celebrate our 25th anniversary next year. So it's quite indeed a revolution and an achievement to not only have created the organization, but also maintaining it alive. And I would say also to the point you were making in terms of each organization keeping its autonomy in defending, I would say, their remit and their geographies or their constituencies, but that EBC is still able to create this enabling framework where, as this beautiful expression says, trying to create a tide that lifts all the boats at the same time. And it's not because one is being lifted that it is to the detriment of another. There is this overarching objective that is supporting every member organization and every member society in everything they do.
Yeah, it's a fantastic achievement. And I also think that what you are saying, that one thing is founding an organization, but another thing is maintaining it. And 25 years is really something to be proud of. But then, Fred, to give our listeners a peek behind the curtains, how do you actually work to get brain health recognized as an important health issue in the EU? What are your target groups for your work? Who are you sort of lobbying up to?
Okay, I've got the impression this question is a bit like a matryoshka. So there are like two, three sub questions. That's extremely interesting. So our primary target group, and I come back to history now, was the European Commission, and in particular the Directorate General, what we call the DG, responsible for research and innovation, that was in charge of developing what I was mentioning earlier, the framework programs for research and innovation, which are 7 years plan of funding and launching of calls, etc. But what's interesting is that with time, we realized that it was not enough to say, basically, we need more money for researchers. There is always the question of why we need this. And what's the purpose? And hence, the work that EBC had initiated on demonstrating the societal burden of brain disorders. So a lot of work being done back in the day. So the first one was in 2004, if memory serves me. And then in different sequences, trying to demonstrate like the epidemiological, but also economic cost and burden to Europe of brain conditions. And then it really peaked with what has been probably recognized as the most comprehensive study there, which was a study released in 2011, where we had the whole of neurological disorders back then recognized as such, and then the whole of psychiatric diseases. It's probably, having a few gaps if we look at it now, but still, we were coming up with a narrative of 800 billion euros being the cost for managing brain conditions every year in Europe. If you ask me, I cannot relate what 800 billion actually represents. But if you start making comparison, and if you remember the financial crisis that we have gone through and the need to support Greece back then, it's the equivalent of bailing out the Greek debt 7 times. And we are doing it every year. So simply in terms of magnitude, it's extremely important. I know that EN and other societies are now revisiting these figures, etc. So I think we need to maintain the level of awareness there. But the point is to say that when we compare, and when I said that neuroscience was lagging behind in comparison to other fields of biomedical research, we are not here to say that it's not important to invest into cancer research or the research on heart diseases or whatever. But it's just to say that we need to find this right proportion between the burden of disease, the cost to society, the challenge we are trying to address, and the capacity we give to our researchers or clinicians to address that societal challenge. So basically here, it's the framework of the narrative and the story that we are trying to tell, not only to civil servants, but with time, you know, to any policymaker and even now to the public, to try and raise this awareness about like why we are standing there to say that in the context of a framework program for research, we need more resources, or we need, let's say, a better strategic vision as to what is necessary in order to address what, I mean, what is at the end of the day a public interest and a public health need. And transforming that narrative, because now I'm coming to one of another sub-question, how we are doing it, we have also been transforming that narrative. Because when I say, you know, 800 billion is the cost, it's highly impacting, you know, back then we were saying it's one in three. These were WHO figures. We know that it is way more now. I mean, two in three, and potentially every one of us is experiencing, if we think of mental health issues, for instance, we can certainly relate that it is omnipresent in society. So highly impacting, but still we need more money. There were new cures back then. So we were developing a narrative that was extremely negatively connoted, but still we were hoping to convince policymakers to give money to researchers. So we have completely flipped that. So in the how we are building this advocacy work, I think now we really need to emphasize what is working. Biology is delivering. You were talking about a revolution earlier. I think that the revolution in the brain space is in the making, and we need to actually emphasize that the more we can. And of course, there is still a huge unmet need. There are still many issues that we need to address. But if we take it by what is working, we can actually attract better attention. We create this kind of positive message, and hopefully this is driving, let's say, a new agenda or new wave that can help us address still the pain points, the bottlenecks, and what actually is necessary to continuously drive, let's say, positive outcomes for people living with a brain condition in Europe.
I think that is extremely interesting that we are going away from the narrative, which was very important to establish, how much it actually costs. And I once heard you say at the lecture that one should turn to the right and then to the left, look at the neighbor on both sides, and that one of them would have a brain disease during his or her lifespan. Absolutely. And that was quite touching because billions is so hard to grasp, I think. But to look at the person to your right and look at the person to your left and think, okay, one of us will be affected by a brain disease was quite heavy to grasp. But then I also see that there is a shift, and I think that's very useful, towards a more positive, constructive way of handling this. And then we go right into the Brain Awareness Week in Brussels, which we just experienced. And that was a fantastic experience, I have to tell my listeners. There were neurologists, psychiatrists, patients, people like you, Fred, who are superb in conveying a message to the public and to the politicians. There were students and all gathered in the European Parliament in order to promote the brain and also to give politicians and other policymakers insight into what are the possibilities, what can be done, and how can we also enable people to take care of their own brain health. And you already mentioned that, Fred, but to you, what were the key messages or themes that stood out this year?
Well, if I look back at the Brain Awareness Week, I think it has been a success in so many ways. It's difficult to maybe grab them all, but I'll single out quite a few that really struck me. And I should probably start first and foremost by what I would call an internal achievement, which has been a fantastic collaboration between organizations. And I'll take this opportunity also to thank and provide kudos to the team at EAN, but equally also at FENS, because EBC, FENS, and EAN were working together to really work towards this successful achievement. Because by that, we demonstrated how multifaceted the story we are telling is, to begin with, but also how complementary the work of all these organizations is, and that it would be difficult to think as to how one can succeed without another one succeeding. And here again, I would make the link between you, clinical neurologists, needing basic neuroscience knowledge in order to then be able to implement it in your day-to-day work, to look after people living with a condition. And these people, you know, very often being supported by caregivers. So, you know, when you say the people right or left, if they are not patients, very often they would end up looking after or being caregiver for someone they know, a child, a parent, a partner. So it really demonstrates how, again, you know, the topic we are talking about is so impacting, is so important, deserves way more attention. And this is definitely what we achieved at the Brain Awareness Week event, because that collaboration and that CRAVE really gave a fantastic, I would say, fruition in terms of the political message. I mean, the exhibition that the Brain Health Mission organized in the European Parliament was, to me, absolutely fantastic. Mm. Having the President of the European Parliament and some of the Vice Presidents coming, I mean, it's massive, the support that she expressed. And I think that we should really cherish and nurture is absolutely fantastic. And the fact that, you know, FENS invited a Nobel Prize winner to come for the lecture in the afternoon, I mean, to us is again, you know, a peak in terms of the momentum, the need for action, the need for getting policy support. And this is really what we should capitalize upon, because the Brain Awareness Week event was organized really a few days or a couple of weeks after a public hearing in the European Parliament in the Committee on Public Health, where the strategy for neurological health was discussed. So the importance of the event was really that not only in itself it was important, but the momentum was important. And it was really supporting the points that were made to say, look, we need to look at these issues in a holistic way across the life course, that we could not create or recreate the silos that we were trying to break over the history. You know, I mentioned the history of EBC, but it's not something we have been doing alone. So this kind of overarching and inclusive understanding of the issues that we are trying to address, not because, you know, it's romantic and beautiful to do that, but it's because if you want to address dementia in, you know, the late course of your life, you need to look at it as early as possible in the life course, and that trauma in the childhood can be impacting for the rest of your life. And, you know, it's if we don't grasp that, and if we don't convey that message, we would be really missing this opportunity. And I believe this is what we confirmed with the Brain Awareness Week event.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it was fantastic. And to the listeners, I have to tell that it also showed how brain diseases affect us all, because Angelica Winter, one of the parliamentarians, she was actually hosting the event at the EU Parliament. She's from Austria and a politician from Austria. And she had a touching speech where she told about her husband suffering from very rapidly progressing Alzheimer's and how he died eventually, and that was extremely touching. And also other politicians told us about their family histories where they had family members suffering from brain disease, and that was rather strong. I mean, I've been working with patients for so long, but every time you hear these strong stories, you're still very moved and touched by it. And it also shows that there is a personal reason for this willingness to accept brain health as a very important term. So that was the personal aspect of that. And that was, as I said, very moving. But let's talk about something else, because we talk about the personal aspect and the cost. But you have also said, Fred, that to invest in brain health is not only good for the individual, but also a smart economic move for Europe. And that was also something that I heard from others at the This Brain event. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by that is a real demonstration that there is a return on investment whenever we invest into improved outcomes for people living with a brain condition. What does it mean? It means that very often we have seen that monies allocated to healthcare spending was a cost. You know, I mentioned even our own study back in 2011. We say it's the cost and the burden of brain disorders. And actually, one of the first pitfalls that we needed to correct when we released the study, because of course we said, like, look, it's massive, prioritized brain research and so on and so forth. But then there were even some governments who turned to EBC or to some of our colleagues in the national networks who said, like, look, we are in the middle of a healthcare reform. We need to make savings. Thanks for pointing out that it is so expensive to deal with brain disorders. So we are going to cut there for first, because that's the most expensive item. And we said, no, actually, it's a mistake. Recognize it as an investment, because it would be worse if you were not spending that money.
Exactly.
And we came up with this concept of the, no longer the cost of treatment, but the cost of the non-treatment, the cost of not investing. And this was the starting point, and it collided with me joining EBC, where we had to rethink a little bit, let's say, our strategy, our positioning, and I mentioned the change of narrative and all of that. But the idea of the cost of non-treatment as a starting point has been really the start of a reflection process of how do we demonstrate that, and then how do we turn that into, again, a positive story. And the cost of non-treatment became the start of a value of treatment study. So where we identified the moment where there was an issue of access to care, so what we called the treatment gap back then, we had a couple of case studies ranging from Alzheimer's, Parkinson, to schizophrenia in the psychiatric space. But we also had lesser known conditions like restless legs disorder, normal pressure hydrocephalus. So things that were a little bit, let's say, more niche, more special, lesser known. But what was fantastic is that, again, with the member societies, member organizations of EBC, we managed to pull the expertise in each of the case studies identified. We had a patient-centered approach of understanding what was the patient journey across the system and where was the moment where there was a gap in the access to care. Whilst in most of the cases, the intervention actually existed, but the patient didn't have access. And we started calculating, okay, what does it cost, or what would be the investment necessary to bridge the gap and to allow for that access? So that means investing into multidisciplinary teams, reinforcing, workforce, the number of beds in hospitals, or whatever it was, ranging, again, from epilepsy, migraine, dementia, and all the rest of it. But what we demonstrated is that whatever the condition was, in investing into improved outcomes was cost-saving or cost-efficient. And there we had a compelling evidence that we brought forward in our report. And again, it was the outcome of a fantastic work with all member organizations of EBC being involved in that. And we now have this study, I mean, which is now almost 10 years old, but still extremely relevant in the conversations of today, in making the understand the economic aspect of brain conditions. As you were saying, it's left, right, and center in our society. It's immensely impacting personally for families, for societies, for employers, but I would say at a macroeconomic level as well. And I would say here, it's not an icing on the cake, but I would say it's a next level of recognition of the need for action, is that international circles or international think tanks have been made aware and have really seized that momentum of saying, okay, there is a priority need that we need to do something about it. And lately was the World Economic Forum who actually started a reflection on the concept of the brain economy and starting on, okay, the burden of disease, the need for positive brain health, the need for investment into brain innovation and the uptake of innovation in our healthcare systems, making our healthcare systems more robust, but also investing in brain skills, in neurodevelopment, in skills for the future, because this is creating the virtuous circle of workplace productivity, but also economic growth and economic development. And this is no... okay, it's very much US-driven and Anglo-Saxon, if you ask me.
Yes.
But still, it's enabling us to make the point that we are not only calling for improved brain health or positive brain health just from a healthcare perspective. There is a broader societal dimension, which at the end of the day is making us realize that if we do not have a productive workforce, we cannot sustain the model. And I can even expand by saying with other challenges that we currently have on security and defense, for instance, it's exactly the same. I mean, if we do not have a healthy population, we cannot face the challenges that we have in a very, let's say, unstable geopolitical context. So all of that boils down to what is the capacity for our society to function and to be able to sustain itself, be, let's say, healthy, be wealthy, and be productive and integrated in society to support one another.
Yes, that was so nicely put, and I agree 100%. And to make sure that to have a robust brain health, make also societies robust, is so important to emphasize, I think. That was nicely done. And we also had, for the listeners, just a very concrete example, to ride an e-bike without a helmet at a very fast speed and then to injure your brain has consequences for the rest of your life, but not only for you, but also for those around you and, of course, for your capacity to participate as a citizen. So these are the small things that can be done in the daily life by society, because as you also said previously, Fred, brain health is not only a responsibility of the healthcare system or the neuroscientists or the neurologists, psychiatrists, patients, whatever. It's a society thing because it's society that's going to profit from that, especially in these turbulent times. I thought that was very nicely said.
Yeah, and that's probably also creating a degree of complexity also how to address that and enter the positive narrative of making everyone aware, but also responsible of, you know, their potential outcomes further down in life. But indeed, there is a question as to what is the exact percentage of brain disorders or neurological diseases that you can prevent with a healthy lifestyle. But when we think of simple things in our day-to-day life, now the question is indeed, how can we make that message approachable, understandable, but also embedded into everyone's daily life. And I think that the work that you have been doing with engaging the young generation into this awareness is absolutely fantastic and was extremely needed. So congratulations for that.
Yeah. It makes so much fun, actually. And I'm also very impressed by the colleagues who are doing these school challenges and so on, where children are involved in how to take care of their brain. And of course, it's a very positive effect because it's not only the children. They go home and then they tell their parents and they ask their grandparents. And
absolutely.
It's a sort of very positive effect for the whole of society.
Absolutely.
And this is what we need. And we also, I also think it's a very important, it's a different aspect, but also to say that, okay, you have a neurological disease, you have a brain disease, but there are still things you can do in order to prevent from getting worse or in order to increase your quality of life, and also in order to be more independent, which of course is foremost an effect for the individual, but of course it also has a society effect. Let's go back a little bit to policy, because this is so interesting. We sort of get very much lost. Can you explain to me, Fred, and the listeners, how decisions make at the policy level actually affect our daily lives or access to care? What is the link between policy and in my life, so to say?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Yana, because it's the one I'm putting forward to even colleagues on a regular basis and it basically boils down to say the work we are doing in an office in Brussels across the European Commission to convince them to, you know, prioritize the brain or to provide more money for researchers, etc., only has sense and does only make sense if sooner or later it impacts and improves the daily life of people experiencing that, or the daily life of clinicians looking after them, or the daily life of researchers struggling to maintain their research and their teams and producing their work. So the direct impact, I mean, obviously, is extremely difficult to measure. But if we look at I mean, some of the figures, etc. And if we see, when I said that the framework programs when EBC was created were completely under prioritizing brain research, the multiplicator since then has been absolutely fantastic and enormous. I would be foolish to say it's only due to the work of EBC. I think it's due to the like-mindedness that was created within the community, and that in turn has really pushed or has spilled over to civil servants and policymakers to say, hey, look, there is a community out there that is trying to say something. We should probably listen. And actually, they are not that wrong when they, you know, they're asking for more support and stuff like that. So, you know, there is that movement that we can generate. But there is also an articulation between what we do in Brussels, and I mentioned it earlier, with what is being done at a national level, and I would even say at a local level in some countries, that creating that chain of implementation, but also of resonance between what is being done at a local level into this kind of European mothership, but I would even say also scaling up to the international level, because we have organizations such as the WHO, even the UN. I mentioned the World Economic Forum earlier. They are all also navigating above us, but I think it's important that we feed them with what we do experience, but also the way we are supporting national societies, national brain councils, local organizations, not only in the advocacy work, but also in the work of supporting sometimes like peer group for patients or local healthcare institutions, networks or facilities. So there is really that vision as to what is the impact, how do we measure it? It's extremely difficult, but creating those interconnections and interpenetrations is absolutely necessary. Otherwise, you know, we can continue drinking coffee with civil servants in the European Commission, but what's the point at the end of the day?
That's true. But actually, you're providing hope as well, because you're saying that what is happening at the EU level actually has consequences for citizens living in Germany and in France and in England and even also in Norway. We're not part of the EU, but we're still very closely connected. So, and this is important because it also gives a little hope for European partnership, which is extremely important these days, not absolutely only in brain cases, I have to add.
No, I think we should spare maybe our listeners to the complexity of the EU institutional model, because it could be endless and probably the topic of 10 other podcasts. But just to say that there is still a repartition of power between like the member states dealing with the organization and the financing of healthcare systems. But still there are, let's say, strategies or ways by which we can coordinate or act at a European level. And that has been the vision of EBC in the context of the last EU elections, to emphasize that notion of coordination and establishing a coordination plan to try and get like all the different initiatives by stakeholders or by institutions, but to synergize a little bit better. And we have a fantastic momentum now, because I mentioned this hearing in the Committee on Public Health, where President-elect actually contributed, and a few of other members, a member of EN also was there, and of ENS, so the Association of Neurosurgeons, each providing, I would say, a lens and a focus on how to advance a European strategy for neurological care. And so we are now touching what could become something that can inspire and that can guide the implementation of national strategies and the way by which countries will need to respond to common objectives, and potentially also encouraging them to collaborate on certain issues, like we experienced with the European reference networks, for instance, in the context of rare disorders. So we have this mechanism of how collaboration in a European context can actually leverage profit. And you mentioned the European partnership. So this is a fantastic milestone in us being able to structure the work across countries, across funding agencies within countries, that put money together in order to support research in the brain space and collaborative research. It's like how teams in Norway, in France, in Germany, in Spain are actually invited to work together in the context of different topics, and recognizing the way by which it is structuring a research ecosystem in the brain space is an ultimate outcome. So it's a great momentum. It's really a turning point for organizations like EBC and all our member societies, amongst which EN, to be able to influence that and be part of that move, but hoping that this is a first step in the right direction. To us, it's not an achievement. It is an achievement in itself, but it should really be seen as, let's say, the potential to move ahead and develop mm-hmm. additional mechanisms, additional sources of funding, etc., for the objectives that we mentioned. Mm-hmm.
So to sum up that, we could say three things. First of all, collaboration is good at the European level, and it's happening, and probably even more so in the recent years than previously. And finally, what happens in Brussels definitely has consequences in Berlin and London and Oslo and Copenhagen and other cities of Europe. And that is a good thing. It's not only divided from real life. But Fred, to make politics is to prioritize. And the most important things must come first. Yes, I see you laugh here. But if you, Fred, could be the one to prioritize one or two changes at the European level that would make the biggest difference for brain health, what would that be?
I would say that the big issue, and I would say the one of the issues we are struggling with at the moment is still a tendency to go back to a degree of fragmentation and silo thinking. So we are back to what I'm calling the kind of pre-EBC era, in the sense that, you know, what I mentioned about the history of the organization is that there was this sense internally and externally that working together was actually necessary, but would actually be instrumental and pays off at the end of the day. And we are now in an age, but it's probably, you know, in many, many different circles, if we see like politics above us and stuff like that, there is probably the tendency of wishing to go alone, because there is probably that thought that going alone enables us to achieve more for our little buckets. But the problem is that it's not sustainable in time, and it is to the detriment of everyone else. And I can relate to that in many different areas. But the fact that we are now advocating for a cohesive vision of what we mean with brain health is definitely the exemplar of that, is that we need to really beware this notion of fragmentation. And, you know, I was in the European Congress of Psychiatry lately making exactly the same point, is that brain health needs to be seen as this cohesive point where all the disciplines represented within EBC, whether medical or non-medical, have an interest in understanding how they benefit from this common agenda. And it's not because we talk about brain health that, again, it is to the detriment of any sub-component of what we mean with brain health. So the vision is really to try and create this enabling framework where we can support all organizations, patient groups, clinical professionals, scientific societies, even the industry to some extent, because at the end of the day, we need everyone to succeed if we want to address or be able to address the challenges that we have identified collectively. And it's not something that we can do on our own. It's not something that we can do in a country alone. And it's not something that we can do in one discipline alone. And predecessors of EBC and, you know, forward thinkers as Jesse Lossen have understood that, and there is definitely a legacy there that we need to maintain and promote. Mm.
So unity would be your foremost priority?
I would say, like the European motto, unity in diversity. So I think that we should actually be aware of the heterogeneity of brain disorders by definition, of the etiology of diseases, but also of our community and the way by which our ecosystem is structured with our organizations, etc. And it's fine. There is a richness in this diversity and this heterogeneity. But the thing is that we should really find those connecting points, those synergies, and nurture that. And I come back to what I said about the Brain Awareness Week event. It's a fantastic demonstration of what I mean here. And we should nurture that success. And again, nurture it in the way that there is the potential to repeat it.
Yeah. Unity and diversity. I like that. time flies when you're in good company, Fred. We are reaching the end of this podcast. But finally, Fred, a message to me and the listeners. What can European citizens do to support brain health across Europe? If somebody's sitting here and listening and saying, what can I do? How can I sort of be promoting brain health? What would you recommend them?
That's a very interesting one. Lately, I've been a critical analyst of the finger model. You know, the finger model that was developed for the prevention of dementia, where we say you need to look at your nutrition, cardiovascular health, do physical activity, be cognitively, mobilized on a regular basis. And then the social engagement. But I think that there are some fingers missing in our hands. You know, if we think of, for instance, the importance of sleep and other components. But again, I think that we should beware not giving too many instructions that they would be difficult to follow up. But if in that, let's say, play of cards, I would rather take that metaphor, that play of cards, if I need to take one, and one that where we see an impact also for young people, I would really emphasize the social engagement. The fact of being like socially active in person, I think that via social media, etc., it's fine, but being hidden behind the screen, I think we are all aware of the long-lasting consequences that it has on the mental and physical health of young people. So that notion of being able to engage, being able to socialize, being able to be exposed also to contradictory thoughts in order to be able to develop critical thinking, analytic thinking, but also an independence of mind. Because in society now, we are also very much aware of the rise of fake news and the incapacity that we see in society to critically analyze what we are exposed to. Because at the end of the day, if we talk about like citizens, what we wish for citizens of today, it's to be able to exercise their right in democracy. And that belongs to positive brain health or boils down to a positive brain health. But that is not only about the disease lens or the prevention of a disease, but it's also the capacity to function in society and be fully integrated.
I think that was so nicely put. To the listeners out there, go out and interact with others. That's probably the best thing you can do for your own brain health and also for the brain health of your society. Thank you so much, Fred, for joining this podcast and for a very interesting discussion and a lot of very important reflections. Very happy to know that you are one of the main persons in the European Brain Council taking charge of enlightening our politicians and policymakers Europe-wide. So thank you for joining, and thank you for our listeners for joining us on the Brain Health Mission podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode and are interested in brain health, follow us on your preferred podcast platform, share it with your network, and stay tuned for more conversations on brain health. Thank you so much again, Fred.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where science meets action for a healthier brain. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an update. For more tools, tips, and expert insights, head to brainhealthmission.org. That's brainhealthmission.org. Until next time, take care of your brain. It's the only one you've got.